Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Graduate Council of the Academic Senate, it's my very great pleasure to welcome you today in the second of the two Hitchcock lectures to be provided by Professor Joel Cohen. Unfortunately, I couldn't make the first one, but I've heard wonderful things about it, so I'm very much looking forward to this. The Hitchcock Professorship is one of the earliest and most cherished endowments at the University of California, Berkeley. It was developed from a bequest of property made in 1885 by Dr. Charles M. Hitchcock, a San Francisco physician with an extensive interest in education. The intention of his bequest was to establish a professorship at the University of California for the purpose of giving free lectures on scientific and practical subjects. In 1930, Dr. Hitchcock's daughter, Lily Hitchcock Coit, of Coit Tower fame, contributed additional funds to the memory of her father and mother. She was, during her lifetime, considered to be one of San Francisco's most colorful figures, and San Francisco is famous for those. An enthusiastic supporter of education, Mrs. Coit regularly mingled with the intellectual giants of her day, such as Robert Louis Stevenson, poet Joaquin Miller, and Professor Joseph LeConte of the University of California. Her generous gift expanded her father's original gift, making it possible for the university to liberalize the terms of the professorship and to present a series of Hitchcock professors. The list in your program of those who have served as Hitchcock lecturers and Hitchcock professors demonstrates the extent to which this endowment has enabled the University of California to become closely acquainted with the most distinguished scholars throughout the academic world. The university is proud to see the tradition of the Hitchcock professorship so eminently upheld by Professor Joel Cohen. At lunch today, Professor Cohen said he was actually thrilled to be among such a select group of scientists, the who's who of American science, including, I think, three of his committee members when he was a graduate student. Professor Cohen is considered by many to be one of the foremost authorities in international population matters and demographic planning. He is the Abby Rockefeller Mosaic Professor of Populations at Rockefeller University, New York, and with his other head, he's at Columbia University, the Professor of International and Public Affairs and Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences, and with his third head, heads the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller and Columbia Universities. Professor Cohen's research data deals with demography, ecology, epidemiology, and social organization of human and non-human populations, as well as the mathematical concepts relevant to these fields. His contribution to these areas constitutes a refreshingly objective critique of modern population concerns. Professor Cohen's studies of human population dynamics began in the 1970s. He observed that neither birth rates nor death rates were constant over time, and developed an important mathematical model representing these random fluctuations. This work laid the foundation for more realistic assessments of the uncertainty of future human population size and composition. His research on food webs was the first to call attention to regularities in the feeding relationships in ecological communities and became the basis for the development of food web ecology over the last 20 years. For his work in advancing environmental understanding of human population dynamics, Professor Cohen was the co-recipient of the 1999 Tyler Prize for Achievement in Environment. In March 1997, he received the Olivia Shefflin Nordberg Prize for Excellence in Writing in the Population Sciences in recognition of his book, How Many People Can the Earth Support? Professor Cohen was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1989, the American Philosophical Society in 1994, and the U.S. National Academy of Sciences in 1997. He received doctorates in applied mathematics in 1970 and population science and tropical public health in 1973 from Harvard University. In addition to serving on many boards and committees, Professor Cohen is a member of the Educational Advisory Board of the Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, and a trustee of the Black Rock Forest Preserve. As director of the board of the Societal Institute of Mathematical Sciences, a nonprofit organization dedicated to bringing mathematical methods to bear on social problems, Professor Cohen helped improve monitoring of air and water quality, less polluting energy production, and more effective AIDS analysis, modeling, and prevention. In his lecture today, entitled Human Carrying Capacity, Concepts, Methods, and Models, Professor Cohen presents the state of the art in today's population sciences and explores again the uncertainty of human population growth in light of the technological advances, political undercurrents, and societal norms that inevitably affect population growth. And so without further delay, it's my great pleasure to present Professor Joel Cohen.
Thank you very much, Dean Mason, for that beautiful introduction. I wish my mother were here to hear it. She would like to believe it. Can you hear me in the very last row? Okay. I'd like to have a show of hands. If you were here yesterday and heard most of or a good part of the talk, would you put your hand up? Okay. If you were not here yesterday and didn't hear most of the talk, would you put your hand up? More. And if you are neither of the previous categories, would you please put your hand up? I just wanted to know how many non-Aristotelians there are in the audience. I saw one hand over there. Okay. Well, considering that a good number of people were not here yesterday, I'm going to take a few minutes to review as I move forward to the carrying capacity discussion. The real purpose of this talk is to suggest that the concept of human carrying capacity is a poetic metaphor gone awry. Let's take another metaphor. Plato's model of the Republic talks about the Republic as a human body with a head, the philosopher king, and with arms, the military, and with feet, the merchants and makers of artisans at the bottom who actually made things. And that metaphor persists in our language when we talk about a head of state. Actually, if you take the head off a body, the body ceases functioning. But if you take the head of state off a state, the state behaves in a different way, finds another head, and functions in a different way. So our language embodies misleading metaphors that lead us often to act in ways that are not appropriate. The concept of carrying capacity is one of those concepts that had a sensible origin and has been applied in ways that I think are less than sensible. The origin of the concept was somewhere in the decade of the 20s, 1910s, 20s, 30s, when people were talking about the management of stock, cattle, on rangelands. And the observation was that you could put on, let's say, 1,000 hectares of land, a certain number of cattle without degrading the grasses and the forbs and the bushes that grew there. But if you went over a certain amount, you had overgrazing. Once again, I will ask those with telephones, beepers, and direct interventions from higher powers to please turn off your electronic devices. So anyway, that was found that empirically that you could only put up to a certain number of cattle on an area, and beyond that you degraded the area. The same thing was then found for wildlife. If you removed the predators of deer in an area and the deer population grew, there would be such a degradation of the plant life that there would be a population crash. And this was empirically observed. So it's well-founded and it makes sense. And the concept of carrying capacity makes sense over a short time period, too short for evolution to occur. Because if the population did crash, there would be adaptations, both in the vegetation and in the deer population, and over time there would be adaptations, as we can demonstrate today in microbial populations grown in test tubes with fixed supplies of nutrients. So within a specific time frame, that is the ecological time frame of interest to humans, and within a specific set of organisms, carrying capacity makes sense. But the point of my talk yesterday was to suggest that carrying capacity for humans is not a matter only of numbers of humans, but interacts with other characteristics of human activity. And I used this image, and I think you can leave the lights up. Can you read that in the back? Okay, leave the lights up. And I talked about the fact that we have 6 billion population now, and I want to say two things about that that I didn't say yesterday. If you took all 6 billion people on the planet, you know, we're mostly water, at least 90%. So let's suppose we converted all 6 billion into soup, and we spread it uniformly over the face of the Earth. How thick would it be? It would be about half a micron thick. I invite you as an exercise to do this calculation. So it doesn't look like we're a lot. On the other hand, since the last ice age, our population has increased by 1,000, from roughly 5 or 6 million, somewhere between 2 and 20 million, to 6 billion today. That's a 1,000-fold increase. And I don't know anybody who believes that the Earth can support another 1,000-fold increase over the next 10,000 years. So on that scale, we are certainly constrained to grow at less than 0.07% per year over the next 10 millennia. 0.07% per year. We are currently growing about 200 times faster than that, about 1.3%. Is that 200 times? No, 20 times, sorry. 7 into 130 is roughly 20. So we have an adjustment to make. It's not clear how quickly we have to make it, but we certainly have to lower. If we're going to grow another 1,000 times, we have to lower our growth rate by a factor of 20. And most people think we're going to have to lower it a lot more than that. So I talked about the population aspect, that it's not just the numbers of people, but their interaction with the economy, environment, and culture that is the complex we have to deal with. Economically, the population, the economy grew 16-fold in the last century, the size of the world economy. Inanimate energy production grew 95-fold between 1860 and 1990. Participation in the labor force of women doubled between 1970 and 1990. And at the same time, environmentally, our input of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere went up about 8-fold in the last century. Water withdrawals from available fresh water went up about 8-fold. Nitrogen production, I didn't talk about it because I didn't have time, but it was on the slide, in some cases went up 25-fold. Humans now put more nitrogen into the atmosphere than all natural sources combined. So we're having a huge impact in the environment. And culturally, we're streaming together in cities, and we have mastered for the first time the capacity to wipe ourselves out completely with our weapons of mass destruction. So we're facing really new issues. And the question I want to ask in this talk is whether the concepts that we have for thinking about how many people the Earth can support are in any way adequate to the facts that I've just tried to describe. I suggested that not only is there one population of one pyramid of population, economics, environment, and culture, but there are thousands of these interacting in a complex way. Nevertheless, in the 1992 Rio Conference on the Environment and Development, one of the conclusions of the final act was a recommendation that an assessment should also be made of national population-carrying capacity in the context of satisfaction of human needs and sustainable development, and special attention should be given to critical resources such as water and land and environmental factors such as ecosystem health and biodiversity. I tried to suggest yesterday that the notion of national population carrying capacity has limited relevance to a situation where your country and my country can trade. I gave the example of a country with bad soil but a lot of it, and a country with little soil but a lot of fertilizer, who could, if they could trade, could support a much larger population than if both were separated and had to grow in isolation. So trade renders dubious the notion of national population carrying capacity. And I suggested yesterday that the question, how many people can the Earth support, implies how many with many choices, how many with average level of what material well-being, with what distribution of well-being, with what technology, with what domestic and international political institutions, what domestic and international economic arrangements, with what domestic and international demographic arrangements, with how many species do we wish to preserve, with what variability, risk, and for over what time, and with what values. And I want to come back to a question that was asked to me at the end about certain demographic arrangements. A gentleman asked me whether I thought that homosexuality would help solve the population problem. Is that gentleman here by any chance? Well, maybe he didn't like my answer. Anyway, I thought about it some more, and I just wanted to put a quantitative spin on my answer. If you, we're going to make in our minds here an XY plot. On this axis is the fraction of women of childbearing age who are using modern methods of contraception. It ranges from 0 to roughly 70%. And on this axis is the total fertility rate. That is, the total number of children in a lifetime that a woman has at the national fertility rates of her country. Okay? In populations where the contraceptive prevalence is about, modern contraceptive prevalence is about 0, TFR is typically 6.5 children per woman. And where the contraceptive prevalence rate is about 70%, the TFR is typically about 1.5 children per woman. And it's basically a straight line when you look at the data, which means that each additional 15% of the population using modern methods of contraception reduces the TFR by about one child. 15% more women contracepting in modern ways, reduction by one child. Now, I don't know of any suggestion that the fraction of the population that's homosexual is more than 15%. So that places an upper, if you think of people who are homosexual as perfectly contracepting, which may not be right, but that's an upper bound, then you would have at most a one-child reduction. So it would make a limited difference in countries where the total fertility rate is significantly above replacement levels, above 2. But in countries that are just on the border of replacement levels, it could make a contribution. It could reduce by that half child necessary to attain replacement. So that's some further sort of quantitative thought about that question. Anyway, these are the choices that we have to make if we're going to think about how many people the Earth can support. I surveyed, and I've displayed here, the estimates. It says, you can't read it, but it says 1994 estimates in billions of people. In 1994 alone, 5 estimates were published of how many people the Earth can support. David Pimentel said, you can support fewer than 3 billion. And he assumed half a hectare of farmland per person and farms operating on solar power. Now, I emphasize those assumptions because the actual amount of farmland per person today is about 0.22 hectare per person, 0.22. So we're actually already at less than half of what he thinks is required, and it's not surprising that the population he thinks we can support is less than half of where we are. He's assuming that we have to run farms on solar power. No fossil fuels, no other kinds of fuels. Then Lester Brown and Hal Kane said, well, the most grain we can grow in 2030 is 2.1 billion tons of grain. And Americans consume about 800 kilograms of grain per person per year, not directly, but in the form of grain fed to beef or other cattle, which then gets consumed as meat, whereas Indians consume about 200 kilograms of grain per year. So if you take this harvest and divide it either by this number or that number, with this number you get the high capacity 10.5, with this number you get the low capacity of 2.6. So the implication here is that if the world wants to go veggie, then we can support 10.5 billion. In fact, we could feed 10 billion people today with the grain that we grow. If people want to eat an American-style diet with 25% or more of calories from animal fats, then we can only support about half of what we've got. Paul Wagner said, well, let's double the area of farmed land. He hasn't identified where that land is. And let's assume a diet on the order of 3,000 to 6,000 kilocalories a day. I remind you that a person needs about 2,000 kilocalories a day, but some of this is going to go into animals and then come through to people. And in that case, if you double farmed land, he says you can easily support more than 10 billion. Václav Smil says, if we could just clean up our act and stop feeding the rodents and the insects that eat 40% of the crop in some countries, and stop wasting the 2/3 of the water that we use for irrigation that never gets to the plant because it leaks out through leaky irrigation canals, without any other increase, we could probably feed 10 to 11 billion. And the Scientific Council for the Dutch government says, well, it really depends on how you want to live, and you could have between 11 and 44 billion. I just want to point out that there's more than a tenfold difference among estimates published in the same year, and they all claim to be good science. And this is a review slide. This is 1 billion people, 10 billion, 100 billion, 1,000 billion. And can you see this red curve here? I don't know if you can see it. No. Yes? No? A little bit. Okay. These are the estimates of how many people the Earth can support by the year of publication, starting with Antony van Leeuwenhoek in 1679 and ending up in 94 with the estimates that I just showed you. And they fluctuate around the 6 billion level where we are, which is my reason for taking this somewhat a little bit seriously, to see whether all these people have thought about it, they've come up with numbers that are in here, what's behind the thought, and why do these numbers scatter so highly? In this slide, I've reproduced those estimates, but extended the time scale out to another 100 years or so, and added the history of human population growth and three projections of the future. First of all, I'd like you to note that on this logarithmic scale, the history is curved upwards. It's not a straight line. It's curved up like that. That's called convex. And if it's convex on a log scale, that means that the growth rate is faster than exponential. The rate of increase of the human population was increasing throughout human history up to 1965. Looking into the future, if growth rates, population growth in 1990 continued as it had been, in about 150 years, we'd have about 800 billion people on the planet. Nobody believes that's plausible, and in fact, the growth rates have dropped. If in 1990, all the women of the world suddenly decided, okay, I'm having 2.1 children and no more, that's replacement level, then the population, like a very, very heavy, long train, would take about 50 years to coast to a stop and would level off, in this calculation, at about 8 billion people. And if in 1990, all women decided to have about 1.7 children during their lifetime, the population would peak around 2050 and then slowly begin to decline here. No matter which way you slice it, we're already in this zone where a lot of estimates are. And as I said yesterday, about half of the estimates lie between 4 billion and 16 billion. But we have a range from less than 1 billion to more than 1 trillion, and the answer, question is why. And the answer is it depends on the methods. That says methods of estimating human carrying capacity. And this is the nuts and bolts. We've gotten past the grand generalities and we're getting into the nitty-gritty. The first method is the method of assertion. It works like this. It's true because I said so. Now, there's one great advantage of this method. It does not require a lot of data. The drawback of this method is that the standard deviation of the estimates you get this way is enormous, because you can say whatever you want. But a lot of estimates that you read in the papers are of this kind. There's very little behind them. The next method is Antony von Leeuwenhoek's method, and I want to describe it to you. By the way, he was investigating the reproductive physiology of fish, and he noticed that the number of sperm that this fish had, the milt, was incredibly numerous. And to persuade you how numerous this was, he wanted to show you that this was more than the Earth, more than the number of people the Earth would ever have. So here's the calculation he did. He said, I live in Holland. There are 1 million people in my Holland, which was approximately correct. And Holland is one part in 13,400 of the habitable land area of the Earth. And it's inconceivable that the Earth could have more people on it, more densely populated, than my Holland. Therefore, the maximum number of people on Earth is 13,400 times 1 million, which is 13.4 billion. So that's how he got his number. In 1695, Gregory King in London said, well, we can do a little bit better than that. The maximum possible population density is higher in the tropics than it is at the North Pole, clearly. So he divided the Earth into latitudinal bands of about 30 degrees, 0 to 30, 30 to 60, 60 to 90, estimated the maximum population density in each of those, multiplied by the area, and came up with a number on the order of 11 billion. Well, that's not a ridiculous notion, because looking at the maximum population density includes all the things that people use land for farming, for recreation, for housing, for roads, all those things. But his estimate of the maximum population, 1 million in that area of Holland, has changed with time so that there are now 15 million people in that same place. And most people that I know would be uncomfortable with the notion that 15 times 13 billion people would be the maximum population of the Earth. So some people are not so happy with that. But this method gives us a chance to find out whether we really have a lot of people now by ecological standards, and I'm going to explain that. If you take carnivores and omnivorous mammals that are alive today and measure the mass of the adult body in each species, on this axis, this is log of body mass in kilograms. And if you measure their population density in their range where they occur on this, that's the number of individuals per square kilometer, and you actually plot the data, these are the real data. And if you fit a straight line to that, you get this one for North American species, this is a confidence interval, and this one for larger tropical species, smaller tropical species and larger tropical species. And then if you take the human population of the Earth 12,000 years ago, just after the last ice age, when we had, before we had invented agricultural technology, you find that we fall right in here, exactly where you would expect from these larger tropical species, which is where people were. And if you plot where we are today, we have moved up three orders of magnitude, that's a thousandfold, and we're out here, and we're a complete outlier. So if you use the method of maximum density, you can say that before we invented agricultural technology, we were just like the other carnivores and omnivores on the Earth. And now we are in a situation that's really quite different, and we can't use the purely ecological standards to understand our situation. But there are a lot of people by a factor, three orders of magnitude. Okay, so let me go back for a second. The next method is the method of curve fitting, and it works like this. In 1920, a professor at Johns Hopkins University named Raymond Pearl took all of the U.S. censuses from 1790, which was the first one, up to 1910, and fitted what he regarded as Newton's law of population growth. Actually, he wanted it to be called Pearl's law of population growth, but he thought it was like Newton's. The logistic curve, which is one that increases and then bends over. And he published this in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 1920 and predicted with high precision the number of people in the United States then. It also predicted with high precision the number of people in 1930 and in 1940. And it also predicted that the maximum number of people in the United States ever would be 197 million because the curve bends over. Well, the population listened until about 1940, and then around 1950, it decided to do something different. And there was, you may recall, a baby boom. Some of you may have been the products of that demographic event. And in 1960, the population was here, and 70, and 80, and 90, and now we're up here. So the population went its own way. In 1924, he predicted that the maximum population of the Earth would be 2 billion people. And the population, in fact, passed that number somewhere between 1927 and 1930, setting a record for the short time in which a theory was falsified in demography. He did not learn from experience. So in 1936, he predicted that the maximum population of the Earth would be 2.6 billion, and that would be reached around the year 2100. And the Earth, in fact, passed that population in the early 1950s, as you know, and we're now at 6 billion. This brought such discredit to demography that demographers no longer do this kind of curve fitting at all. It's just considered amateur. And yet, if you look in the pages of Nature and Science, there's still a lot of talk about fitting of curves of this kind, simple deterministic curves to past population time series. So we've talked about assertion, maximum density, curve fitting, the single limiting factor. This is very popular. I'm going to talk about these two together, and then these two, and that will cover it. The single limiting factor. Well, everybody has to eat, right? You no eat, no live. So let's figure out how many people the Earth can support by estimating the maximum food production, some quantity like this, and then we divide it up into as many little pieces as we possibly can, each piece sufficient to feed one person. We take the year's production of food, we find out the annual food requirement, minimum, and we divide the biggest numerator by the smallest denominator, and that gives you the maximum population. And that seems pretty objective. It looked scientific when it was proposed in the beginning of this century. Nibs was an Australian who proposed this around 1912. But the problem is, what is the maximum global food production? Are we going to use sticks or satellite-directed tractors? And what cultivars? Are we going to use biotechnology or not? And are we going to have fertilizers or not? And are we going to have irrigation or not? Are we going to have credit for women farmers or not? What social institutions are we going to have to support the food production? That determines this. And then, what's the individual food requirement? Is it the 200 kilograms that an Indian vegetarian eats, or is it the 800 that an American carnivore eats, or is it the 400 kilograms of grain a year that an Italian eats with a higher life expectancy than either Americans or Indians? So what is the choice here? And incidentally, from a practical point of view, why, if the world could produce a huge quantity of food, would the people involved consent to eat the absolute minimal amount of food for subsistence? And incidentally, what is food? What is food? The anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss said, "Food must be good to think before it can be good to eat." So is a cow that's a holy animal food, or is it a Big Mac on wheels? I asked this yesterday. Is a dog a pet or a square meal? If food were only biologically constrained, the people in New York, where I live, would have no problem about eating the cockroaches, which provide such an abundant source of animal protein. But I don't know anybody who eats the cockroaches. But they're there, and they're food. So what food is a cultural matter, and if you look into the details of single-cell algae, some people regard it as food, and some people don't regard it as food. It has to be good to think before it's good to eat. Well, the notion that there is a single limiting factor and that it's food is contradicted by many studies. Here's one that says Brian Skinner, geologist at Yale, and a man of great distinction. More than any other factor, availability of water determines the ultimate population capacity of a geographic province. The same thing has been said, replacing the term water by food, land, energy, nitrogen, phosphorus, light, soil, space, diseases, waste disposal, etc., etc. And the people who do this never check to see whether their favorite limiting factor, be it food or water or land, is going to intervene before the other limiting factors or how they interact. So I want to offer, if we're going to take water seriously, I want to offer another approach to the carrying capacity concept that shows the interplay between constraints and choices. You may remember in my talk yesterday, I said there's a two-word summary, and the two words are constraints and choices. So here we go. The amount, this is going to take a little bit of explaining, so the amount of fresh water annually that's available for people to use, that means it doesn't fall in the ocean, and it doesn't fall in some remote place where there aren't any people, and it doesn't get carried away in a flood. So that's the available runoff that you could use for irrigation, okay? That is about, some different people estimated between 9,000 cubic kilometers a year and 14,000 cubic kilometers a year. So let's start with the case of 9,000 cubic kilometers a year. Suppose we used all of that to grow irrigated wheat. Well, every plant has something called a transpiration ratio. It's the amount of water you have to put on the plant in a pot in a greenhouse to get 1 kilogram of plant. And it's usually on the order of a couple of hundred. So if you want 1 kilogram of wheat plant, you got to put in a couple of hundred kilograms of water. I think the number for wheat is around 200 or something like that. I don't remember the exact number. It's several hundred. And half of the wheat plant is grain, and the other half of it is chaff that you don't eat. So you have to double that 200, say, to 400. And then there are irrigation losses. And from each kilogram, for each gram of carbohydrate that you get from the grain, you get 4 calories. So you can calculate how much water it takes at a minimum to get a calorie from a wheat plant that you're irrigating. And then you make some assumptions about how much of the harvest you lose, 20%, and how much of the water runs off without being used, how much you can, which is about 80%. You really can't use more than about 20% without degrading your environment very severely. And you go through a whole series of calculations, which are described in detail in my book, which I urge you to go out and buy. And you come up with a conclusion that if you want everybody, if everybody in the world is content with a vegetarian diet of 2,000 kilocalories per day. And if the amount of water available is 9,000 cubic kilometers per year, then you could support 7.5 billion people. That's this point right here. Okay? But if everybody wants to have 15% of calories from meat, and you have a diet that requires the input, the raising of 6,500 kilocalories per day of grain to feed the domestic animals, then you can only support 2.5 billion people. That's this curve. So here is a curve which shows you your choices. This is the frontier of choices. You want more calories? With 9,000 cubic kilometers, you can support fewer people. Is that a clear notion? I've left out many details, but is the notion clear? If, on the other hand, you invest a lot in dams, and you have 5,000 cubic kilometers of dams, then you can capture 14,000 cubic kilometers of water, and you can support more people at each level of chosen caloric input. And if you put in 19,000, we have about 10,000 cubic kilometers of dams today, so we can get up to 19,000 perhaps. Then you can have more. If you don't have that many dams, or if they're filled up with silt, as they will fill up, your carrying capacity drops. So now, in the next picture, I'm going to take these four curves and put them on a three-dimensional graph. And here we have, this is the horizontal axis before, this is the wheat calories per day, and this is the choices that you've made about how much water supply, depending on the dams that you've built, and this is a response surface of population that you can feed from wheat that's grown by irrigated agriculture only. And instead of thinking about carrying capacity as a single number, you can think about it as a response to choices concerning wheat energy, water supply, and a whole lot of other things, like how do you manage your pests, many other dimensions, but it's a surface over a range of choices. Well, one thing that's totally unrealistic about this is that it's completely deterministic. And in fact, the rainfall varies widely from one place to another. We can't predict. So this is a static, deterministic model, but it shows a way of thinking about carrying capacity that goes beyond a world without choice. And that's the difference between us and cattle. We have choices. This is the seventh of the methods of estimating carrying capacity. And this one is a diagram from Beyond the Limits. This is the successor book, the 20th anniversary reprise of The Limits to Growth by Donella Meadows. This is by Meadows and some of her colleagues. And this is what I call a spaghetti diagram. The Limits to Growth is a computer model based on several hundred variables in a computer program that is so complex even the authors don't understand it, as I'm going to come back and show you. It's a form of science fiction in which you use the computer to work out the plot. There are many variables here, and there are no empirical data in the limits to growth except the population of the world in 1900 and 1970. Just aren't any data. Those are the only two numbers that come out of the real world. So if you're interested, I have a few copies of a paper which reviews these methods that I've just talked about, and I may or may not have brought them. Well, we'll see. So now I'm going to go one better, and I'm going to give you a model that has almost no data in it, but tries to deal with the dynamics of population. And this is technical. I'll do this relatively quickly. So, let's go back. In 1798, Thomas Robert Malthus had a very important insight. He said, the happiness of a country does not depend absolutely on its poverty or its riches, upon its youth or its age, upon its being thinly or fully inhabited, but upon the rapidity with which it is increasing, upon the degree in which the yearly increase of food, that's one variable, approaches to the yearly increase of an unrestricted population. That's the other variable. The same point was made almost 200 years later, 190 years later, by Paul DeMaine, a population economist. Posed in the simplest terms, the economics of population reduces to a race between two rates of growth, that of population and economic output. The difference here is that food is now replaced by a more general economic output. This was phrased in another way by a well-known population scientist, President George Bush, who, under the guidance of his political advisors, said in 1992, when Congress was trying to pass a population resolution, every human being represents hands to work and not just another mouth to feed, which is physiologically true. And the question is, what are the implications of having hands as well as a mouth? And what are the tools and technology and resources available to make those hands productive? And so I've invented an imaginary model to explore the consequences of these ideas. It's just as imaginary as Plato's model of the state as a human body, or as the metaphor of people like cattle, except this one is dynamic. And I just want to show it to you. This is play now. This is poetry. This is not serious science. This is pure play. So please understand it in that way. We're going to write two equations, and the variables are population size and human carrying capacity, whatever that means. Whatever it meant to George Bush, it's going to mean in here how many people the Earth can support. And there are two equations. The change in population size during the next time unit is going to be proportional to with some growth rate to the population we have today times the difference between the carrying capacity today and the population today. So if the carrying capacity is 10 million people, 10 billion people, and the population is 3 billion, then we have a big room for growth here, and the population will grow in proportion to how many people we have and this room for growth. On the other hand, if the population exceeds, is bigger than the carrying capacity, this quantity will be negative and the population should decrease. So if there's an overshoot, the population should decrease. And then the second equation is the Condorcet equation. The change in the carrying capacity during the next time unit is some constant times the change in population size during the next time unit. That's thanks to George Bush. It means if you add more people, that increment can increase the carrying capacity because they have more hands. Or if this constant is negative, those additional people pollute more and they can reduce the carrying capacity during the next time unit. So now we're going to just play with these ideas and see what comes out as a result. First, we're going to do it in continuous time, and then we're going to do it in discrete time. Continuous time means differential equations. Has anybody here had differential equations? A few people? Yes, good, a few hands. All right, good. You never knew you'd be seeing differential equations in this talk, did you? Well, here we go. So we take the rate of increase of the population is proportional to the population and the difference between the population and the carrying capacity. The rate of increase of this carrying capacity, how does this change? It changes in proportion to the increase in population. And you can actually solve that equation. And you find, lo and behold, that there are three modes of behavior. When each additional person, let's say additional 10 people, add enough carrying capacity to feed an additional 9 people, you get a logistic curve. That's exactly that curve that Raymond Perle used to fit to the population that I showed you earlier. You get that curve again. If this constant is 1, you get exponential population growth. Why? I want you to see why. If this constant is 1, this is a 1, then the increase in the carrying capacity exactly equals the increase in the population, right? In that case, the difference between the carrying capacity and the population doesn't change because this is increasing exactly as fast as that. So this becomes a constant, and this is a constant, and you're left with the equation of exponential population growth. So you get exponential growth. If C is greater than 1, each additional 10 people make it possible for an additional 11 people to live. Then you get what's called the doomsday curve, which is a previously existing curve. The population goes to infinity in a finite time. Let me show you that numerically. All of these simulations I'm going to show you start off assuming a population of 3 billion people. That's how many we had in 1960. And a carrying capacity, which I made up out of my imagination, of 10 billion people. And here, there's an invisible dotted line up here. The constant C, this constant C, is going to be zero. If C is equal to zero, there's no change in the carrying capacity at all, and this is simply a constant. And that gives us, that gives us this curve. The carrying capacity up here is constant. The population grows logistically, just like Pearl's curve. If you start again with 3 billion people and a 10 billion carrying capacity and a 0.9 value of C, each additional 10 people add enough for another 9 people, and the carrying capacity goes up to 73 billion, and the population levels off. But the shape of this curve is, again, purely logistic. If C is minus 0.1, so that each additional 10 people pollute enough to reduce the capacity of the Earth by one person, then the carrying capacity comes down, and the population grows up and levels off where they collide. If you set the that coefficient C equal to 1, you get exponential growth. And if you set it to 1.1 and run this in your computer, the thing runs along happily. Notice the time scale here. This is 10 to the 198th. That's the units, which is the limit of what my computer could represent internally. The thing, population grows and grows and grows until it goes through the ceiling, and then the computer says, I quit. And that's going to infinity. So now let's try to make this a shade more realistic by doing the following. Suppose the rate of increase of carrying capacity is not a constant, but its proportion equals the land per person. There's a fixed amount of land on the Earth, and you divide it by the population size. So instead of a constant C, which we had here, we put in the land per person. And then we solve these equations, and you can show there's an equilibrium, blah, blah, blah. I'll skip that. And here's what happens. This is the predicted curve. On a log scale, the population is predicted to grow exponentially, super exponentially, and then to level off. And the carrying capacity is predicted to rise first and then to level off. And these squares are the estimated population size of the Earth, the real population size of the Earth, between the year 0 and the year 1990. And there's a reasonable fit. And what's surprising is that there were a lot of inventions in the early Middle Ages that had a substantial effect in increasing the carrying capacity of the land. I just want to give you some of those inventions. Not that I expect this model to be taken seriously, but Europe grew technologically and economically for a millennium before the Industrial Revolution. In the 13th century, the English forests were cleared, swamps were drained, and new lands were exploited for cultivation. Yields improved as a result of liming, plowing straw ash into the field, and planting new varieties of seeds. The mining and smelting of tin, lead, and iron, the manufacture of pottery, and the production of salt and wool all increased greatly. And there were additional surges of economic development in the 16th century. So, in fact, the carrying capacity led the surge in population in England and in other Western European societies because of technological innovation. I do not believe that this is a reason for predicting that the population will level off at 18 billion, which is what this shows, because there are lots of things that could change between now and the next 50, 10, or 5 years to make that not a good prediction. Let's talk now about the discrete time model. Instead of having a differential equation, we have a difference equation. The population at time t plus 1 is the population at time t plus this increment factor, and the carrying capacity, again, we replace by a discrete equation. We're going to take C less than 1 and let this constant, this is less than 1, and R is going to vary. Constant, we got a whole bunch of different modes of behavior. I just want to show you what they are. The population can grow and overshoot its ultimate carrying capacity. The population can grow and go into a periodic mode with period 2. The population can grow and go into a periodic mode with period 6. The population can grow and go into chaotic modes of behavior. And as many people have pessimistically predicted for the Earth, the population can grow enormously, crash, grow, and then crash below zero, which means go extinct. All of that you can get out of this same model with just variation in one parameter. So a simple model like this can have many, many different modes of behavior. Now I want to go back to the limits to growth. This is from the book Limits Beyond the Limits, and it says their model is capable of four modes of growth: continuous growth, a sigmoid approach to equilibrium, overshoot and oscillation, overshoot and collapse. I showed you that, but I also showed you many additional modes. And my objection to the model in this book, in their book, is that it's so complex they can't understand it. It's not intellectually clear. It's just as unrealistic as mine, but it's too complex to understand. So they were not really able to analyze what they were doing. Well, in the real world, we come back to people making decisions both by their individual choices about reproduction and by their collective choices about politics, economics, and the environmental quality of their countries. And here we see, this is a poster advertising the ideal family size, a mother, a father, and 2 children. And then we see the reality in that society is considerably different. But they are at least being given information and means of attaining this kind of a demographic equilibrium. Well, this is a summary of both of these talks, and I've talked about population growth, economic growth, environmental impact, and increasing contact of cultures. How many people the Earth can support depends on natural constraints and human choices. And what we can do now can be put into 3 broad categories. The bigger pie school says, let's use technology to enlarge the carrying capacity of the Earth. The fewer forks school says, let's limit population growth and limit extravagant consumption, whatever that means, extravagant, limit consumption among those people who are already here. And the better manners school says, let's improve the terms under which people interact. For example, by accounting for the environmental effects of economic activities, by reducing inequalities between men and women, boys and girls, rich and poor, by improving governance, by eliminating corruption and organized violence, by defining property rights to open access resources, by freeing trade, and by removing irrational subsidies to environmental destruction. So I think that all of these approaches are desirable. And I'm going to hold my comments there and invite your questions, reactions, and comments. Thank you very much. Before you ask any questions, if there are any, let me say that on Monday, at 4 p.m. on Monday, September 18th, I'm giving a talk called Cooperation and Self-Interest, Pareto Inefficiency of Nash Equilibria in Finite Random Games in 159 Mulford Hall. That is about the underlying problem that if I have a child, it affects you, and if you have a child, it affects me. The externalities involved in social situations.
Did you give that information?
Yes. Called Cooperation and Self-Interest, and it's in 159 Mulford Hall. And I want to warn you that this is a mathematical talk. it's intended to be intelligible to the non-specialist, but if you're not at home in the poetry of mathematics, you're not going to be at home in part of the talk. And then on Tuesday, September 19th at 7:30, I'm giving a showing of films on population issues to present different perspectives that people have, and then to have a discussion on how do these films identify who the actors are, what the problems are, and what the possible solutions are, and what factors do they consider in looking at these problems. So I hope that that will be a conversation, not just a lecture. Any questions, comments? Yes, sir.
As I recall, Eric recently said that he was going to give one more pass at raising popular consciousness about the problem. And if it was ineffectual, he was going to say it's life code ethics, everybody on their own. Are you one who subscribe to that? Do you think that the existing institutional structures are capable of coping with the situation?
Well, I haven't heard this statement, so I'm relying entirely on what I've just heard from you.
Is that? It was a media statement.
Okay. So could you hear in the back what the statement was?
No.
Okay. According to the gentleman, Paul Ehrlich recently made a media statement that he was going to make one more pass at raising popular consciousness about the problem. Those were your words, right?
Right.
Whatever the problem is.
Well, population.
Population problem. And that if he did not succeed, from here on out, it would be lifeboat ethics. Is that right?
That's right.
Everybody for himself,
right,
or herself.
Right.
Right? And what's my view on that? Is that the question?
Right.
And do I think that institutions are around for coping with this situation? I don't understand the concept of lifeboat ethics in this world, because we are, in many respects, highly interdependent. On my flight out here, I saw a movie in flight called Outbreak. Has anybody here seen Outbreak? Okay. It starts with a quote from my former boss, Josh Lederberg, a Nobel laureate in microbiology, who said, "The chief challenge to human beings is to deal with the viruses." And then it talks about an outbreak of a virus that's extremely lethal. And it gets into the United States in various different ways. And the question is whether they're going to have to bomb some town in California out of existence in order to contain the epidemic. Meanwhile, it's already spread to Boston. Heaven forbid they should bomb Boston. California, it's OK. So, the fact is, lifeboat ethics does not make sense in today's world, where we are so strongly linked by migration. You know, there was an outbreak of pneumonic TB in Bombay several years ago. And Margaret Hamburg, MD, was the health commissioner of the city of New York, and couldn't get money out of the mayor's office to monitor TB in people on the streets. And then this was in the newspaper. She called up the mayor and said, "Mr. Mayor, there are 20 nonstop flights a day coming into JFK from Bombay. You want to do something about it?" And she had been trying for weeks to get through them. He called her back in 20 minutes and said, "Shall we shut down the airport?" And she said, "No, just give us money to follow what's going on." The notion of lifeboat ethics in a world where microbes exist is ridiculous. The well-being of children, of every one of us in this room, is interdependent with the well-being of people elsewhere. But it's also independent economically. You know, I don't think there's probably anybody in this room who isn't wearing a piece of clothing with fabric or material that was sewn or grown somewhere else. What are we talking about? Lifeboat ethics. We and they are linked in the same boat. So I applaud Paul Ehrlich's efforts to raise consciousness That I applaud 100%. But I don't think we have any choice but to succeed. So that's kind of a two-sided. Okay? We have to succeed. Whether we have the institutions is up to us to decide. Whether we wish to act to encourage our government to get involved to the extent that its means permit to give other people choices in the demographic area.
Do you think that the concept of ecological footprint is useful in thinking about human carrying capacity?
I think ecological footprint is a new set of clothes for many of these same ideas. And I have reservations about it because it's not sufficiently explicit about the dependence of the estimates you get on the technology and on the social institutions, all of which are subject to choice. We have a choice whether we wish to, for example, the United States, one favorite example is to take the city of Reno, Nevada, and say it's got this huge footprint because the area of land you have to gather water over to supply the water needs of Reno is enormous if you don't use fossil water. But we have a choice. We are the only country that uses drinking water to flush toilets. Why do we do that? Well, there are many alternatives. You don't have to use drinking water to flush toilets. And you could change the ecological footprint of a city substantially by reusing gray water. So if you don't take the ecological footprint estimates too seriously, or if you understand them as one possible outcome, that, then it's fine. But I'm very skeptical. Yes, sir. One is life expectancy. How long are people living? Two is survival, which is correlated to that, survival to age 5. We currently waste half the children born alive in some of the developing countries. That's a scandal. Third is literacy. If you can't read and write, you're cut off from human culture. What's the point of being a human? So I think that those, and I would particularly emphasize women's literacy, but literacy for both males and females. Those are things that I look at on particularly. They're kind of simple.
What was the question?
What was the question? The question is, what are my favorite indicators? What are the things that I look at to see how well we're doing? And I would say life expectancy, survival to age 5, and literacy, especially women's literacy. I was in Ouagadougou. You know, I went around the world in November, and one stop was Burkina Faso, which is a country of 11 million people in West Africa, one of the poorest countries in the world. And from Burkina Faso, I flew, after a stop for a week in the Middle East, to Japan, the richest country in the world. In Burkina Faso, the expectation of life is about 46 years. In Japan, it's over 80, the longest in the world. In Burkina Faso, the fraction of adult women who can read is 9%. In Japan, it's 100%. In Burkina Faso, the income per person is $250 a year. In Japan, it's $40,000 a year. They're not the same planet. And the opportunities of a young child in one culture or the other are so vastly different that it's simply beyond belief. So I think that is a concern which should be addressed not by bringing down the high, but by bringing up the people at the bottom. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Observation, you use the word choice.
Yes, sir.
Quite a bit. And by the way, I love the work that you're doing. But when you say we have a choice to let flush our toilet flush water or not, we don't here. I cannot do that. I'm not going to go get seawater or something carried up to my San Francisco apartment.
Right.
So what I want to, my point is that to distinguish between the individual as an agent who can choose,
right,
so between alternatives and systems.
Absolutely.
We're talking about large systems.
I am indeed. So the gentleman's point is absolutely correct, and the point was, when I talk about choice, he doesn't have the option of flushing his toilets with salt water or some other gray water, because the system is already in place. So when I'm talking about choice, I'm talking both about individual choices and about collective choices, which we make in the systems. We, you know, I've never designed a sanitary supply system, although I've studied how to design it. But I'm not responsible for the fact that we don't use sensible water. But we are responsible in a political sense that we can pick issues. Paul Ehrlich has picked the number of people as his issue, and that's a good issue to pick. There are other issues, like, can we use water in a sensible way? And can we design transport systems that are sensible? And can we design educational systems that are sensible so that everybody gets a chance to get educated? So you're absolutely right. It's the collective aspect of choice which is most neglected. You know, you can eat all the bean sprouts you want, but until we get organized collectively, we are missing opportunities. That's really what the topic, it's the individual versus collective choice, self-interest versus cooperation, that is the topic of my talk on Monday. Yes, ma'am.
And when you say the past, you have factors on your pyramid. You have factors that would all impact the current capacity. But you never give us a mathematical model for culture. How can we, you can't do the analysis in a robust way unless you have a mathematical model for culture.
The complaint, which is justified, is that I haven't given a mathematical model for culture. We can quantify these other things. If there are any doctoral students in the room who would like to address this complaint, I'd be happy to work with you. I have lots of ideas. The fact is that there are now one-third of the world has radios. That's a quantitative fact of some significance. And probably, you know, it could increase by a lot as these things get really, really cheap. So how do we quantify the effect of culture? Well, we can do it through literacy, through possession of radios, through knowledge about other cultures. I'd like to see a model of that kind developed, but I haven't done it yet. So there's room for further work. Professor Rubin.
Back to Eric. I've heard sociologists who are saying social movements rise, wax, mature, and fade. Eric might phrase it a little differently. The pendulum swings. And Eric now recognizes that the pendulum has swung against him and is waiting for it to swing back. Will it?
The question was, Ehrlich says that the pendulum of concern about population is a pendulum that swings from one side to the other. It has swung against him, and he is waiting for it to swing back. And the question is, will it swing back? I don't have a crystal ball, but my anticipation is that if it swings back, it won't be the same pendulum. If you look in the newspaper, the Swiss are concerned about the fact that they have 19% of their population immigrants. And there's plenty of concern about immigration. It may not be the number of people as to compared with where are they coming from. The United States has a pretty good tradition and capacity of dealing with people from many different cultures. And I am the grandchild of immigrants, and I'm awfully grateful that the United States is able to cope with immigrants, because I would be either dead or not, you know, incapacitated if I weren't here, if my grandparents hadn't immigrated here. But immigration is going to be a major issue all over the world. So what's going to swing back is no longer how many people, but where are they coming from and what are they bringing with them in terms of culture and skills. As long as 44% of the world's people are living in countries with below replacement fertility, the concern is not going to be focused on fertility as much as it is on aging, urbanization, and migration. Those are going to be the three concerns that are going to come back, and it'll not be the pendulum that Paul Ehrlich swung. I think those are the issues that we're going to have to look to in population over the next quarter of a century, maybe half a century. Okay, two more questions and then it's time to quit. Gentleman in the back, and then you.
Yeah, and in California, we tend to be very well fed, and we're like a country that's the best fed in the world. But also, we have a problem with obesity. How do you think we could curtail that in the future?
Remark was that in California, we're very well fed, and we have a problem with obesity, and how could we curtail that? Eat a sensible diet and exercise enough.
I've heard it said that the...
That's a serious answer. I think that, excuse me for interrupting you. I do think, but it's such a familiar answer that, it sounds like a joke. I think that this is a matter of individual choice. You don't have to eat greasy fries. You don't have to eat greasy food. You can choose when you go into the grocery store. There's all kinds of good stuff there. And you can just pick your own diet, and you can walk to the grocery store and walk back. That's how you do it, sir.
I've heard it said that the three variables which control population growth are, one, standard of living, social security, and birth control technology. Do those still hold as far as, is that?
He's heard it said that the three variables that control population growth are standard of living, standard of living,
social security
for retirement,
yeah,
and birth control. That's plausible and may be true for a lot of cases. These things are so correlated, and there are other things that are correlated with them, like level of education, women's rights, political involvement and stability. There are lots of different things that are involved. And the problem is that these things keep shifting in time. What's true in one historical period does not remain true. We can see that even in the last half century. In the decade 1950 to 1960, the developing countries that experienced a rapid decline in fertility were those with a high level of literacy, 60 to 70%. By the end of the century, in the last decade, the countries that were undergoing a rapid decline in fertility, were those with a level of literacy of about 20%. Education had no longer been a sine qua non for beginning a rapid decline in fertility. Why? Because people were watching the soap operas. And the soap operas showed the happy family with two kids and the problems of having 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 kids. And people decided there were alternatives. They could send their girls to school instead of having 5 sons to work on the farm. And they'd be better off if they sent their daughter to school. They saw it in the soap operas. They heard it on the soaps. So literacy is changing. I think people should be literate, not because it's going to reduce their fertility, but because they have more fun in life. And they'll be connected with their cultures. And they'll be able to be better parents and better earners. But mainly they'll have more fun. So, thanks a lot.